Welcome to Idle Red Hands, a podcast from Japan about gaming and gamer life. And welcome to Idle Red Hands. I'm Chris.
I'm Wayne.
I'm Lyle. And I'm trying to think of what I could bring up in of things that I've done that are related to games, but over the weekend, all I did was watch season 2 of Sons of Anarchy.
The entirety of season 2, thank you very much.
And a movie called Vera Drake that's about back alley abortions in
lovely
the 50s. 50s England. Yeah.
Which one was bloodier, the movie or Sons of Anarchy?
Sons of Anarchy.
Wow.
They didn't really get that graphic in Vera Drake, right. But it's actually like a really sweet family. So you really like the family, and then kind of unfolds, and it's a really good movie, and nothing to do with gaming.
Right.
Yeah, okay. You really wouldn't want to play this. You want a borderline impoverished family, the mother gives abortions. Yeah. But, yeah, amazing actress.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, speaking of other movies that you can't take anything away from for gaming, I got about halfway through 47 Ronin before I turned it off, because... Yeah.
So like 23 and a half Ronin.
Yeah, somewhere around there. Yeah.
Was it, I'm using air quotes here, good enough for the bad movie, good game episodes?
No, because it doesn't, well, I guess the thing to take out of it for a good gaming episode would be...
Yourself. Sorry.
Nah, it would be like, okay, let's myth up this historical time period.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's other movies you could do that, you know, pull the same element out of. So maybe it would be good fodder for an L5R game, you know, to watch that. But if you're trying to get people excited to play L5R, the movie's dark. It's Keanu Reeves. It's kind of boring where it'd be like, yeah, how about we don't play that? You'll have to see it. It's like a duel between Keanu Reeves, and I'm using air quotes here, duel between Keanu Reeves and this other kind of faceless guy. And you're like, you guys are kind of just street brawling with swords in front of the emperor right there. And I don't really think that's how it would work.
Hmm.
You know, like kicking people and knocking them off pedestals and stuff. And you're like, whatever. But I don't know. It just did not excite me. So, yeah, happy, happy fun time. And now I've lost all our listeners because I'm sure a lot of people like that movie.
Sorry, I got nothing going. My whole family was sick with the flu all week, so, yeah, I got nothing.
So 47 Ronin would actually have been a step up.
Actually, it would have been.
All right.
Not sure how to transition that one.
Well, last year I did a paper on the tabletop gaming industry. It was for an MBA. So I was surprised that they let me do it, but I kind of pitched it as, hey, this industry is in trouble and looking for ways to save it, in particular through digital ways.
Mm.
So that's why my advisor was somebody who's an expert on digital, the transition in the music industry from analog to digital.
Oh, cool.
And how that's affected things.
So you pitched it correctly.
I pitched it correctly, and... So I wrote a paper and also had two surveys, which a lot of people were kind enough and gracious enough to take. And I gathered that data and then looked at it. So I've shared that with Chris and Wayne, and they've had an opportunity to look through the results. So in this episode, we are going to talk about the results. And in part two, we're going to look at a thing that marketing uses a lot called a positioning map, where you... look at a lot of products and see where they fall on a spectrum. It needs a little bit of a setup, so that's why it's going to be moved to the second part. And we're also going to look at what does that mean, and just in general, how do things look for the gaming industry, and what could be the future for the gaming industry.
I remember after you did the survey, you had some, I thought, pretty interesting ideas that came out of it.
Oh, thank you. Sorry, I was in the middle of drinking there.
Sorry. I was waiting for something.
So when I sat down to write the paper, my advisor suggested I write a literature review. and just research what's already been written about the industry, and allow that to shape the questions I ask, the theories I have, and to spot any gaps in what's already been written, and as well as look at what's been written about similar industries such as collectible card games, video computer games. And that advice proved to be incredibly helpful, and some particularly helpful works were, for example, Playing at the World by John Peterson, Of Dice and Men by David W. Ewalt, The Evolution of Fantasy Role-Playing Games by Michael J. Treska, and others. Like, there's an anthology series called First Person, Second Person, Third Person. It focused more on computer games, but also role-playing games in general. And stuff like Henry Jenkins' Convergence Theory, which looks at how the media is used and how it's the use of media is evolving.
Right.
Cool.
So what were you looking for when you set up this survey?
In the literature, I was looking for why were people attracted to it in the past, like to tabletop role-playing games in the past. Mm-hmm. And of course, you can use your own. I mean, if you play role-playing games, you can use your own experience, but you want to kind of get a broader spectrum and see, is this the same for everybody else? Try to see if you could find reasons why it declined.
Mm-hmm.
I was also looking for why things like collectible card games, there was a surge in popularity, how that impacted tabletop role-playing games, and then try to use the survey as a way to get sort of a snapshot of where it is now. So what did people like about role-playing games in the past? What did attracted them to the games in the past? And then try to see if those things held true.
Hmm.
For example, when did people start? How did they start? Like, how were they introduced to it? And again, applying those to the survey. And yeah, so, and what I found was a lot of the things, like from my own experience, were pretty similar to a lot of people. Like, people were attracted to the same things. Like why did you guys start playing tabletop role-playing games?
I'm honestly trying to remember why I started. I just remember seeing it. Either I encountered it somehow, either on TV or just by walking past like a store that was selling it, and just kind of thought that looked cool. You know, the mostly it was those little men that I saw, and then I figured out there was a game that went along with it later, and then, I don't know, it was kind of wanting to be, I don't know, it sounds weird now, but cool, because older kids than me were playing it, and anything older kids do is instantly cool, especially if you get excluded.
Yeah, I've told the story before. I was sold to me by a guy in a back alley with kleptomania.
Yeah, but
probably stolen from somebody else.
But why, Chris? Why did you take that first thing?
Because I didn't want to get beat up by the guy. No,
yeah, there you go.
Because the red book had a big picture, a full color picture of a dragon on the front, and that was awesome. And inside there are all kinds of other pictures of monsters and rules on how to play against the monsters. And yeah, just my little mind exploded.
Actually, it was in the John Peterson book that probably captured why I started playing, and it's pretty basic. And it was the idea of playing make-believe at an age where you shouldn't be doing that as much.
You mean like 35?
Yeah. And we continue on. But it gave a justification for playing with toys, in a sense.
Right.
I started playing at a time when I was transitioning from playing with like full-on toys, such as like Star Wars or G.I. Joe.
Hmm.
And I guess trying to do more grown-up things. You know, but I'm talking about like 12, 11 or 12.
Right, right.
Maybe 10.
Well,
but these games with the nice covers, and you're playing characters that are similar to the toys that you have. So yeah, it was like a justification or a set of rules on how to continue playing as a kid.
Yeah, that's true. I think kind of with Chris on this one, like even before the justification for playing, the actual game came around, at least for me, was just these books are cool. And yeah, like look at those covers with the dragon and look at all those, you know, cool characters and scenes inside the book. And then yeah, it kind of gets you like, oh, I can be those characters in that book and have that awesome adventure that these pictures are showing me, and wouldn't that be cool? And yeah, then there, as you said, Lyle, there's kind of the transition of, I'm too old to play with toys, and this is, well, I say that as a man with like a closet full of board games and Legos, but this is kind of a way for me to get around being too old for toys by playing this game.
So what I was, and these books that I brought up, like Playing at the World or Of Dice and Men, a lot of it was, they weren't saying, here's the industry and here's a dry survey of it, but they were talking about the history of the industry. And the history of the industry, you look at, you find out what were the innovations that they introduced. And through those innovations, you try to find like competitive advantages, like things that tabletop role-playing games might still possess that gives it an edge over other games. But when you're looking at the history, you're seeing men that went from, I guess, toys, and then they start playing war games, which are toys with rules.
Right, right.
And then one of the innovations, or some of the innovations introduced by a guy named David Wesley, was like, is to make the games more free. And you had, I mean, war games did have a referee often, but this person really played and was really integral to the game. And people kind of went off and did their own thing, and they had their own goals, as opposed to having an army.
Mm-hmm.
And he did that by just adapting the like a war game. Like, I think it was in the Napoleonic era, but I could be wrong. So we see that. So then they kind of pulled that out of the literature review. So we got freedom, individuality or individual characters. Does it still have that?
Yeah, I think you mentioned one of the other things was having a character that that carries over from game to game.
Yeah.
And advances.
Right,
and grows.
Right. I remember right. that too, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and that was another one, and the idea of a living history. So they contrasted that with a board game, which resets when you pack it away.
Hmm.
Whereas this is what you did in the last session affects what happened in this game.
Hmm.
But then you also see another innovation, which was one of the, could still be one of the competitive advantages of the tabletop role-playing game industry, is the idea of the amount of control that the players have over the world.
I didn't think about that.
Yeah, yeah. And one of the guys said, I think it was Elwett said when he wrote Of Dice and Men, he said one of the problems with the early Dungeons & Dragons game is that it didn't ship with Gary Gygax.
Oh, right. Right.
So he was there with his group explaining what the rules were, but once you write it down and into the rules and you put it in a box and you send it out, and then people are just like, well, what is this game? I can't understand it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've heard one of the strengths of like AD&D 1E or even, you know, the really early Dungeons and Dragons is that it doesn't, I don't know how to put this. The rules as written say improvise, basically, to put it in a nutshell. And I've heard that one of the strengths of that system is the fact that the GM can run it however they want, and that it's going to be different for every DM that runs it, which I don't know, I don't really buy into, but yeah.
Yeah, no, absolutely, and it also gets into, I mean, a lot of these advantages and innovations also have a flip side, a problem, one of them being imagination is free. So at a certain point, you don't need the rules. Or when, like, Elwett was talking about board games, he's saying that one of the problems with board games, or at least the business model, is that barring a house fire or theft.
Right.
Or that I would destroy a Monopoly board in a bankruptcy-induced fit of bad sportsmanship. Parker Brothers got $20 from me, and that's it.
Right.
And he thought that tabletop role-playing games had a better business model in that they can keep adding rules and selling those rules, and which is what a lot of role-playing games do. I mean, that's how Dungeons & Dragons, you know, you just add these different rule books.
Right.
But then if you look something like most of the books, it's just like what you really want to do is get to the point where you close the book and just let your imagination take over. I mean, that's in the vampire book in the near the front.
Right. I suppose the other way to do it is with setting stuff. So, you know, one way is to just keep pumping out more rules, which eventually gets kind of difficult because then you run into rules creep, or, you know, there's only so many situations you can cover. or you need to cover before you're going to repeat yourself. And the other way is to put out setting material that is very rules light, because, yeah, imagination definitely is free, and all a player really needs, or all a group really needs to play a role-playing game is the core rule set, because they can make up everything else. But being creative can actually be quite difficult. And, you know, coming up with all those new places to go and new adventure hooks and whatnot. So I guess the other way to get people to keep spending money is to make that for them so they don't have to do that, or if they're unable to do that.
No, absolutely. And I mean, you can argue that, well, imagination can also factor into setting. In fact, for most people, it's easier to make a setting or easier to make an adventure than a set of rules, but it gets it to a really important currency that comes up, that came up in the literature and something that I wanted to look into, and that's the idea of time. And are people willing to trade money for time? Like you're saying, I mean, you can create your own setting, but if somebody creates a setting for you, that's fun to play. Are you going to be willing to spend the money to get that?
Right.
So that's something that I wanted to explore with the surveys, is like one of the reasons why people weren't playing as much. Other things that came up in the literature review was the idea of like social networks. And this was pretty exciting because, like, even back with the war gamers, they had a problem finding other players. And to the point that the Avalon Hills magazine general offered a Hero Opponents Wanted ads to its subscribers free of charge. Because they realized that if you don't have players, if people can't find opponents and players, they're not going to want to buy the game.
Right.
Ryan Dancy, he used to work for Wizards of the Coast and now works, I believe, for Goblin Works. He said that there's a very small market for people who just like to read and never play TRPG content. So therefore, you got to tap in and try to make sure that there is that network out there. And guys like Bonnie Cook have embraced digital platforms because of the fact that it allows them to get a broader player base.
Right. That's a good point, yeah. With no players, you don't have a game. And all you're doing is sitting there reading these books and thinking how cool they are. Oh, that sounds like me in high school.
And speaking of Ryan Dancy, he brought up something that was probably the biggest revelation, at least for me, and the thing that really shaped my survey, and was the idea of play patterns. And this was fairly pessimistic when you looked at the future of our hobby. And it's the fact that kids develop play patterns like pretty early. And when we started playing our games, what was our competition? I had an Atari at one point.
Yeah, I had one of those.
But I started pre-Nintendo. And he's saying now kids are going towards digital platforms. So they're developing those type of play patterns, as opposed to the kind of play patterns you get where you get a book that's 100 pages or a couple hundred pages, and you read it, and then you do everything in your head.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that we still play these games that we started playing when we were 10 years old, I mean, reinforces the ideas that we will keep these play patterns through adulthood.
Mm-hmm. Right, well, I was going to say, during the convention that I went to last, you know, like late last summer, most of the people, I mean, it was other gaming stuff too, like war games and board games and stuff like that, but I went mostly for the RPGs. And for the most part, the vast majority of people who were playing RPGs were people my age, you know, plus or minus 5 or 10 years around there. I saw very few teenagers. And we mentioned before, I had one in my game. The only reason I think I did is because her father was a gamer and brought her, and she kind of wanted to play. So again, that was offspring of an existing gamer.
Right. And other things that I asked then is like, so if people are developing play patterns from other games, will they transition over from those games, or are there other games that people will play?
Can you emulate those same play patterns in a tabletop role-playing game?
Yeah. And trying to tap, like, what did people think were good gateway games?
Right.
And what were good games for kids? So these are some of the things that came out of, the literature review, which was really helpful. So with the survey, which people could access, and I was actually trying to get results from non-gamers.
Mm-hmm.
And it was under 30, so I determined that was statistically insignificant and rejected all of that data. So I just took all the survey data and then filtered out everybody that said that they don't play the games because it was under 30, and just figured that any answers they give wouldn't have been at any value. So then I just focused purely on the gamers. And of course, there is some flaws in the distribution. I mean, when I tried to put it on non-gaming sites, that was often in violation of their rules. It was like, oh, this is only to talk about science fiction books.
You got pegged for spam.
Yep. And so you get taken off. So the sites that actually would be welcoming and where people would have some incentive to respond are people that are interested in the game. So that is certainly something that has to factor into the results, is that I'm only getting it from people that are actually invested in the game and the hobby. So it would have been very good to get, you know, find out from kids, what are they playing, what do they like, and what do they appeal. But I think a lot of times with the kids, and probably for most people, they don't know what they want until they see it.
Yeah, good point.
So a really good example that a marketing guy did is, he said, if prior to McDonald's, if you had said what would have been a good hamburger restaurant, they would have given you new variations of a better Howard Johnson's.
Right.
And then if you show them McDonald's and you said, would you like that? They might go, yeah, I'd like McDonald's a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But until they see it, they won't necessarily know. So if you describe it to them, they might get it. But if you show it to them, then they'd be like, okay, yeah.
I got it.
Yeah. No, I wouldn't want to play that game. So they'd be like, oh, imagination, sure, I guess I'd want to play that. And then you show them a rule book, no.
Yeah, right. No. Here's 400 pages of imagination.
Yeah. All right, yeah. I'll get back to you in a month.
Yeah. I'm going to imagine myself liking this game.
The gender things could have been, for example, skewed because of what somebody brought up on one site and said that women don't feel all that comfortable going on forums or RPG forums because of the way some other posters act.
Right. I could see
I was going to bring up that point too later on.
But. Yeah. How true that is, I don't know, but it was certainly something that was brought up. And might suggest that some of the data I have, for example, only 8% women play the game. Is that true? Well, you certainly have to take that into consideration.
Right.
With the numbers.
Right. Yeah, I guess the way you can look at it is 8%. Only 8% of women responded. Or, no, that's not correct. 8% of the respondents were female.
Yeah.
That's correct.
That is what that means, yes.
Yep.
Yep. As opposed to 8% of role players are female.
Right. Right.
And before we get started with the survey, you can download it. If you just go online to www.idleredhands.com, and you'll find a link in which you can download the survey. So we're going to divide the results into what didn't surprise us about the results and what did surprise us. So when you guys looked at the results, what were some things that confirmed what you already believed?
Well, actually, that 8% female.
yeah, that was kind of it, too.
Sorry, I know this is already on the very first one, kind of jumps over to the other side of it of what surprised me, but it didn't surprise me at all that there was a very small percentage of respondents were female, but I was surprised at how small it was, actually. I would have, if I was going to guess, I would have guessed something like 20%. So yeah, male domination, pretty much par for the course, yeah. Unfortunately.
I have to agree, I was surprised maybe by how low the number was, but I wasn't surprised that it was significantly lower.
Hmm.
Now, what I did, and this is something where with the second survey, I tried to correct it. So I did post, I think it was on the Paizo forums, and I said, well, you know, I was a little bit surprised at that result, and then somebody volunteered that information that I said. And then I thought, well, what if I ask people what the gender composition of their usual gaming group is, and that bumped it up to 20% female.
Hmm.
Now, that question, though, of course, has some flaws. People could be talking about the same gaming group.
Right.
So certain gaming groups could be overrepresented. So, certainly that question itself is not flawless. But what we see there is it's still a male-dominated hobby, and our anecdotal evidence would back that up, I would imagine, although when you go online, it seems that there's certainly more women playing the game than back when I started.
Hmm. Yeah, that's true. Well,
no, I guess maybe the same for me, but then again, I'm a gamer. It's not like I played or I hung out with many girls back in the day. So, again, hard to say.
Yeah. There's your bias there because I'm a gamer. I hang out with women.
It's the case for me anyway. And I'm going to blame all my social awkwardness on being a gamer.
Yeah. Honestly, that leads right into the part that, was not surprised about. Because one of the questions you asked in the survey, Lyle, was, what do you think prevents people from trying tabletop role-playing games? And the respondents could choose up to 3 responses. And 59% of respondents said that it was the reputation of the hobby.
Really? Now, see, that was going to be one of the things that I said was a surprise for me.
Honestly, it wasn't, as I just said, wasn't that much of a surprise for me.
In what way?
Because I guess the fact that I'm more active on social media than you guys, I do the stupid thing and read the comments for a lot of posts and see stuff like that. And the impression I get is that gamers can be very antisocial, combative, you know, whatever. So the fact that a large percentage of respondents said that they think it's the reputation of the hobby and the people who play it turn people off from trying a role-playing game, that did not surprise me.
Wow. You see, as I've gotten older, like, I'm more comfortable, you know, with myself. So when people say, what do you do for fun, your hobbies, I'll say this, you know, that I'm a gamer. And, you know, back in the day, I remember there being quite a bit of a stigma to it. But nowadays, when I say to people, they say, oh, like D&D, yeah, I played that before. So some of them are even interested in joining in. Again, there is a bit of a bias in that, you know, I'm now an expatriate from the country. So the people I'm talking to aren't really standard representations of other Americans, but right. Still. Yeah, it's, that number surprised me, actually.
So. Sorry, Wayne, what number was that question?
So that was question. Along at home? That was question number 21.
Yeah. Now, I put this question in, and again, it's not without its faults. And one is that I knew I wasn't, even when I was designing the initial survey, I knew I wasn't going to get a lot of non-gamers. So I wanted people to provide their impressions. And this... I'm not surprised by the results either. Other top results were No Time to Play, No People to Play With, and Complexity of the Rules. And,
right.
You know, with the literature review, Complexity of the Rules, No People to Play With, all of these things factored in to some of the struggles people had in the beginning. Certainly, I don't even think I really read the rules when I played the game. I kind of relied on people to tell me what they were as I played them, even though I bought all the rule books.
That's what I do now.
Yeah. So, reputation of the hobby, depictions on the media.
It's that too, yeah.
I mean, there's a very funny in the X-Files where the guy says, you know, I didn't play Dungeons & Dragons all these years without learning a little something about courage.
Yeah.
or the uber nerds and that. So, yeah, I can see that.
No, I kind of saw it as, like my dad always said, like, a person is smart, people are dumb. So, I kind of saw it like, you know what, individually, gamers are probably fine, you know? But... kind of as Lyle said, you know, the media perception of what it is to be a role player and how it's often negatively associated with, you know, a lack of social skills, that is still out there. And whether it's true or not, I think it's that perception and reputation of the hobby and the people who play it that keep a lot of people from playing.
What is the Happy Jacks people have a rule about conventions that every gamer has to follow? Three things that you have to do is like one meal, one shower.
It's like I don't know if they came up with this, but they say it a lot, and it's like 1, 2, 3, 4. It's one shower a day, 2 meals a day, I think that 3 liters of water, and at least 4 hours of sleep.
Right.
Is I think how it went.
Wayne is actually very clean, so his would have been like 4 showers a day.
Oh, it wouldn't be that many. That many. Not that many.
Very dry skin.
20, 21, 22, 23.
No, and the reason I have to say that is because you have to say that in some cases.
So, I guess a long explanation, but yeah, I was not surprised by the data on that.
Yeah. No, I thought, that question didn't surprise me, but the things that really drew my eye was Complexity of Rules, No People to Play With, and No Time to Play.
Hmm.
And those are hurdles, like, even, like, because we're kind of beyond the reputation, and those
right,
kind of matched up is just why people don't play so much. And I really was not surprised by question 20. Like, how, you know, what are the reasons why you don't play?
Hmm.
And number one is no time.
Yeah.
And number two is no people.
Yeah, because without those, it doesn't matter what kind of reputation the hobby has. You're not playing.
Pretty much.
Any other things that weren't a surprise?
The types of games that people play. This is number 22. In that, the number one winner by far is fantasy games. So it still sounds like D&D, Pathfinder, that genre still sounds like king. Number two being science fiction. Again, yeah, that's no surprise there. So, yeah, that was pretty much as expected.
Yeah, so I was not... Yeah, I was not surprised by that either.
That was the one I was going to say, if I had a second one, that also didn't surprise me. To Chris going first kind of stole it, but... Like, sorry. No, that's fine. It just kind of supports the fact that we already had that, you know, preconception, and hey, the data supported it. So,
yeah.
By both of us picking it. But I really wonder why that is, because, like, again, the respondents could select, I believe they could select any types of games that they played. You know, it was what game genres do you like to play? Choose all that apply. But fantasy, like 98% of respondents said they like to play fantasy. That's almost 100% of the respondents enjoy playing fantasy.
Yeah, and I should point out there was the other section, and I've actually filtered it out a bit because people were just repeating what was actually a given genre.
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
I kept steampunk since it came up a few times, and I guess, I suppose it's its own genre.
I'm also seeing post-apocalyptic steampunk in there, so...
Yeah, well, I think that was comma steampunk.
So. Oh, I see, and yeah, okay.
That was yours, wasn't it, Wayne?
No, it
wasn't. Cyberpunk. But, I mean, steampunk is the top two choices. It's fantasy and science fiction.
Fair, good point, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Anime is often fantasy. Mm. It's a different type of fantasy, so...
Yeah.
So, yeah... Mm.
I don't know, this is kind of just throwing guesses in the dark, but it might just be grandfathered in, you know, with, I think a lot of people maybe having learned on D&D, then, they just started with fantasy, and maybe what you were saying about playstyles kind of, getting us when we're young, maybe that's just what people think of as role-playing games now, a fantasy-style game.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't the original Traveller very close to, the time when the original D&D was put out? Off by like 2 years.
I don't think it had anywhere near the market of D&D, though, hey?
But again, if both of these are coming out around the same time, mm-hmm. what was it that that made people grab onto D&D so much mm-hmm. as opposed to Traveller? If you have, again, assuming that you have these two games that are kind of similar in the infancy of the hobby, what made, if what we're saying is true, or what you're kind of postulating is true, what made one people grab onto fantasy so much more than science fiction?
Yeah, it's a good question. And that's not to say that science fiction isn't also very high. You can maybe see the effect of Traveller there. It's at 80%,
right.
Where fantasy is at 98. But, you know, actually kind of moving forward, we're talking about how kids these days have, geez, I sound like an old fogey with that. Kids these days!
Mm-hmm.
About how they're playing the MMORGs online. And you think about the beginning MMORGs are like World of Warcraft and, what's the other one? RuneQuest.
Oh, yeah, EverQuest?
EverQuest, thank you. EverQuest, and both of those are fantasy, so I wonder if this fantasy type is going to carry forward in the future as well.
Yeah, this came up in the literature, and I wasn't, again, not surprised by these results. And it was, when you look at the evolution of war games and what else was going on in the time, was the
right.
explosion of Tolkien.
Right.
And fantasy, but also science fiction fanzines, and that they were also taking off. But these fanzines helped create a social network in which these kind of games could grow. So people would have like the dual hobbies. And then, but in the 70s, science fiction really started to take off.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know why necessarily like fantasy, but if I were to guess, it's because fantasy has more clearly defined roles than science fiction. Science fiction has always been a little out there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost a competition for science fiction writers to do something that's very different from what somebody else has done, at least more at heart.
Right.
Some science fiction people, because they're trying to tell some sort of allegories. And
yeah, that's a very good point. Yeah, science fiction does have to be, it's or good science fiction and like true science fiction as opposed to science fantasy is kind of speculative. So it would kind of have to be out there. But Again, going back to what you said about Tolkien, well, I think around the same time that D&D came out was the Hobbit and the Lord of the Rings being printed in paperback.
That would make a big difference, hey?
not exactly, but it predates it
right.
by about 10 years. Or
oh, okay.
20. So. But what it did is it created the excitement for fantasy.
Right.
So it was in the 60s, and then, D&D came out in the 70s, so you had people that already knew
right.
The vocabulary of fantasy, or what is the vocabulary of science fiction. And maybe, and I'm just throwing this out there, and this is why I got into licensed products. In some of my questions, is that if there had been a Star Wars or a Star Trek game very early in the role-playing game creation, maybe science fiction would have become super popular.
Right.
Now, they came out in the 80s, I believe, for both of those products. But if they had been around at the time of Traveller, would have people just gravitated towards the Star Wars game and played that?
Yeah, I wonder.
Fantasy. But maybe not. Maybe, maybe that gets into what we talked about in another episode is... people are able to extrapolate different character types from Tolkien, maybe because they can't pronounce the names or remember the names of the characters.
Right.
Whereas Han Solo is Han Solo.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, sure, he's a smuggler, but I can't separate that from Han Solo because that's such a clear image. It was a movie. I watched the movie. I saw Harrison Ford as Han Solo. A Jedi is Luke Skywalker. Bad Jedi is Darth Vader.
Right.
I don't know. But that's something I didn't explore too much. But I did ask about licensed products and wondered if that was a way to bring people more into the hobby. For my big not surprise, and the pleasant surprise, not surprise, pleasant surprise, pleasant not surprise, was number 9, the reasons why people play tabletop role-playing games. And they pretty much are what the reasons why people started. And these probably because these people did start way back then. But you're looking at people that like to interact with other people. You're looking at people... that like to create stories, that like to immerse themselves in the setting, and that people didn't really like tactical simulation. People kind of liked character creation, but I think with time, and we've talked about this in episodes, where character creation was a lot of fun when we had a lot of time.
Right.
And now it's not so much.
Mm.
So when we make a Pathfinder character, that's a bit of a job to find time to do that.
First you do the work, then you have the fun.
Yeah, and people don't want to do the work anymore.
So what you're saying is gamers now are lazy bums.
No, gamers just started having these kids that they think is going to be the future of the hobby. And jobs to pay for everything. And
you mean pay for the hobby.
Exactly. Those books aren't cheap. I just noticed on here, drink beer is one of the reasons for
playing. I just looked at that myself.
You can't drink beer at home by yourself?
Yeah. Well, another non-surprise was what influences people's purchasing decisions or how people were introduced into the hobby. And that was, friends or family. And the reason why I say family, because I think a lot of, with the other, people are writing variations of
family,
friends.
My brother, my sister, my cousin, that kind of thing.
My creepy uncle.
I think I took all that data and threw them all in friends. I was like, yeah, come on. If you're playing games with a family member, they're also your friend. But yeah, so it was all like older brother, family, friend. And those were the big ways. And very few other channels introduced role-playing games to people.
Mm.
Like clubs. So things like that. So again, that was the same as my experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, speculation here, but do you think that a lot of respondents saying that more people don't get into tabletop hobbies because of the rules complexity has a lot to do with how people got into the hobbies themselves, meaning through friends, where someone that they could sit down at the table and play and kind of be taught as they were playing rather than reading a rule book?
Sorry to be so blunt, but yeah, entirely.
Yeah, very, very few people would do that. If I was going to draw, this is question 5, if I was going to draw a surprise is how few people, although I'm not surprised that friends was like number one, but clubs, playing at a store, playing at a convention, well, I guess I'm not so surprised by that. They're like 2% each. Playing at a convention was statistically 0%.
Wow.
But then you could factor in is, well, why would you go to the convention if you're not
already playing?
Yeah, familiar with it. Picked up an RPG myself, 15%. And I do know some people that did that, and they picked up these games by themselves, but they never played them.
Mm-hmm.
Because they had no one to play with, and they couldn't really teach themselves how to play it.
Right.
So they went off, at least in the case of one of my friends, he gravitated then towards Magic, where he could find players, and he could pick up the game pretty quickly. But it had the same elements that he liked, the fantasy, and he's also a big computer and video gamer, but...
You know, that actually brings up something else that was a non-surprise for me, which is, and this is questions 4 and 5, where you ask what people would be more likely to buy when it comes to digital editions. And the numbers weren't very high for things like audio and video enhanced PDFs, which didn't really surprise me all that much because I figured that people get a lot of their information via friends taught how to play when they meet people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I actually thought of something... similar to this, Wayne, when you were trying to teach me Netrunner, you sent me a link to Fantasy Flight's video instruction for it.
Right.
And my eyes just glazed over when it started talking about it, and then you do this on your turn and that on your turn, and it's just not the same when somebody explains it to you.
Right.
I'm in the same way. People have done that, and especially if it's long, and you're just like, I don't have time for a 30-minute tutorial.
Yeah, exactly.
And there are some really good ones where some very, like if they were sitting across the table from you, they would be doing a fantastic job of explaining this game.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, it's just boring. And I probably shouldn't be surprised by the results of that, but I was a little bit surprised because, and this is a case of back into the people don't see the McDonald's until you show them the McDonald's, is that I think what was in my head was much cooler than what I wrote on the survey, or at least sounded cooler to me, in that if you have anticipating the problems of no time, no friends, What could you have, like, surrogate friends that, like, videos or audios to help enhance both the gameplay, but also to enhance or to help you learn the game.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, it's still shaky. And one way to make digital products more valuable or worthwhile, because from my own experience, I prefer books over digital products. So what would be a way to make me flip to prefer a digital product? Which is, you know, it's easier to distribute, so it's good for a gaming company. But then you also have the pirating.
Yeah.
Out of curiosity, would audio or video enhancement make you flip to a digital edition?
It's one of the things where you really have to test it. I'm gonna have to say my play pattern is established.
So that's a no. Yeah.
Yeah. So. And I try to then differentiate it with the question is, like, what do you think would attract other players or new players? But I think there's something there where the traditional representation of the game is not working. It needs to be presented in a different way. But, I mean, we like a digital product that's more enhanced with hyperlinks and stuff like that.
Yeah, we certainly do, yeah.
So if you could, I mean, we talked about how great the Pathfinder pictures were, but if you could somehow... You know, when they do the example combats in the book, instead of just like that italicized text of this person speaking, you can see it. You click it, you're reading the content, you click it, and it shows you what happens. And it explains like the combat in an animated way. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, but again, here I am, I'm struggling to explain it, so how would I represent that in the survey? So I think it's something that people should ignore the survey results and explore. Because really, what have you got to lose? Because it's a shrinking hobby.
Right.
And there are some companies, the people that make Eclipse Phase.
Yep.
They got very good result for an audio-enhanced adventure that they had.
Yeah.
I guess it was received very well.
Now, you bringing up Eclipse Phase kind of leads into the thing that I was surprised about. Because question 43, which was an optional question, was how often do you download or use pirated copies of tabletop role-playing game materials? And 48% of respondents said never. 35% of respondents said sometimes, which maybe I don't know, I thought that was a bit low. I guess I expected that to be higher. But then question 45 was, have you ever paid for a copy of a tabletop role-playing game that you had previously pirated or received for free? And again, this was an optional question. And 73% of respondents said yes, they had. And the reason I'm thinking of Eclipse Phase when you brought it up, Lyle, is Post-Human Studios put out torrents of all the Eclipse Phase material, legal torrents, and they actually kind of, you know, said, we want you to get a copy of this book. And the first page of the PDF said, you know, if you like this, please consider buying a copy, because we still have to make money to stay in business, even though we're providing you with this free torrent. I did that, and I was impressed so much that they did it, that even though I, you know, downloaded a copy of nearly every Eclipse Phase book, I've also gone back and purchased them, PDF copies. So it was kind of surprising and nice to see that 73% of respondents have also then paid for something they either pirated or got for free. Yeah. So I'm wondering if the Post-Human Studio model is a viable one.
It's the Radiohead model as well. And that was something that came from the music industry, is, you know, Louis C.K. tried it for comedy. Yeah, I don't think so.
Yeah, it's only anecdotal. That's what I do too. But on the other hand, I also don't purchase very many games.
Yeah.
I have pretty strict guidelines between what things I'll read through and what things I actually move on to purchase.
Yeah, I think a company like an established artist like Radiohead can do that model.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you were anybody else, what you would be doing is giving away the digital music for free and not receiving much money back. And relying on people to like you enough to go see you in concert for music. And that was something that I wanted to explore with the survey, is whether or not there could be other models. Like, could you make money in other ways, like conventions or events? And one of the results was that most people just play with friends, and where they play is mostly at people's houses.
Right.
So I don't know if that's going to be possible. Like, you can't necessarily have a... Although, I'll maybe talk about this in the next episode, because another podcast did have an idea that I thought was pretty good, that it was along those lines. But we get review copies sometimes, and I have bought a few of them because I like them and I want to have a physical copy.
Right.
But not a lot of, I don't think that's something that the industry can rely on.
Mm. Well,
it's people's, like, the honor system, I guess.
Right. No, but I mean, then you look at question like 45A, and, you know, if you said yes to purchasing a copy of a tabletop game, that role-playing game that you had previously pirated, again, 42% of the respondents said they were only using the pirated version to preview the game. So I guess if you look at those two numbers together, you could assume that, yeah, people are going to pirate stuff. If they like it, at least, maybe not a majority, but a large enough number of people are then going to pay for it. So, yeah, you're right. A company would not make as much money just selling product normally. But, I don't know, it does, at least to me, say that people are willing to pay for things that they like, even if they got a copy for free.
What I think, instead of giving it away for free, is to lower the prices of some of the PDFs. So to a point where it was, hey, why not?
Right.
Now, I bought a Delta Green bundle from bundleofholding.com, and I actually wanted Delta Green I've wanted it for a long time. I didn't pirate it. So I saw that, and the prices were also low enough that I thought, hey, why not? That's not much of a dent in my pocketbook, and I'll buy these. I prefer books over PDFs, but, you know, this is better than nothing.
Right.
So, but that might be the thing, is to price PDFs with a very, very low margin. And maybe the idea is that people want to buy other things after that.
Hmm.
Yeah. We see things like with Savage Worlds or Marvel Heroic Roleplaying, where the books that they use, the rule books were very, very inexpensive, like $10 or $15.
Yeah.
And the idea is that people get hooked and then want to buy all the other things.
Well, right. I'm only speaking for myself here, Lyle, but I think you're spot on with that assessment. The reason I bought Savage Worlds and Monster Hearts is because they were each only about $10 for the online version. And yeah, that was enough for me to just say, yeah, whatever, I like it enough that I'd like to spend that money, if for nothing else than to support the designer in their game.
Yeah.
No, that's part of the reason why, as much as I don't care for Savage Worlds, and as much as I think Ubiquity and Hollow Earth Expedition is a better system, I cannot fault Pinnacle Entertainment Group for pricing Savage Worlds the way that they do.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess what I'm trying to say is make it easy for people to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And if you are going to sell a PDF for $30 that isn't super enhanced, then sell it for a price that's so low that it's almost free. So people are like, well, I'll buy this because I'm also supporting them and kind of encouraging them to make more product. But if they price the PDFs too much, then people are just going to say, well, I hope somebody buys it.
Right.
Because I don't want to pay that for a PDF.
Well, you know, I think there's a lot of goodwill out there among gamers. This one wasn't specifically to do with downloading, but it was with the crowdfunding websites like Kickstarter and whatnot. The highest reason people contributed to Kickstarter campaigns was to because they wanted to help the game designers to push them to finish it and to create other things. This was question number 15. And it was 47%.
Well, have you guys heard of this thing called Patreon?
Yeah, I have. Only in passing, one of the podcasts I listened to mentioned it.
I've actually, I guess, donated to several people on Patreon. Basically, what it is I believe it started out for the music industry, where the premise of this thing was creators would create music that was then going to be released for free for everyone to access. And it was kind of like a donation system where people could, it had stretch goals in a sense where, you know, they said, if we get up to, you know, $100 a month, then we will do this. Or if we get up to $200 a month, we will do that. And you can give these little monthly donations, and it's kind of extended.
It's forward funding on projects, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, no.
Sorry to interrupt. It's kind of where the way that I heard is that this guy was producing videos, and he said that what you can do is you can sign up and give a specific amount of money, $15, $20, whatever, per video, but it goes into the future. So if he makes a video tomorrow, then you give him $20. If he makes another one next week, you give him another $20, and it's kind of automatically linked to your credit card. At least that's how he explained it.
No, that's true. You can set it up where it's you, the supporters pay per piece of content you release, or and you can then cap your monthly donation to those people, or you can just, they can set it on like a monthly thing. So it's a couple of different ways they can do it. But the important part here is any content released through Patreon, I believe, must be free. Like, it's not Kickstarter, where only backers get a copy.
Uh-huh.
It's you are donating to the artist specifically because you like them, because the thing they are making is going to be accessible to everybody, whether they paid into this or not.
That's really cool.
So I wonder if that's going to take off more, because if a large number of people are backing Kickstarters just because they like designers, not sure how much I buy into that, because Kickstarter to me has kind of become a pre-order, you know, fancy reward system, where Patreon is, everybody's going to get this. I just like your stuff, so here's some money.
Hmm.
Yeah, I think that could work if your name is Radiohead or Monty Cook.
Right.
yeah, I think so. I saw something similar, but it was for charities, and they're trying to promote, instead of just a donation, you can become a sponsor.
Right. From what I understand, Patreon has just kind of started with RPGs.
Nice.
Like, where Kickstarter is now not pretty much, but, you know, game companies are pretty established on Kickstarter, and as I said, it's kind of become that pre-order thing, where Patreon is still kind of in the beginning of, you know, a lot of indie designers have found this thing and kind of adapted something that wasn't initially for role-playing games to work with role-playing game content now.
I mean, there's something really appealing about giving it away for free once it gets made, in that helps build the social network, because people can freely distribute it.
Mm.
And that is something that's exciting about the digital thing, is that it allows people to easily share it, legally or illegally. But even if you're sharing it illegally, you're still expanding the network. And this was something interesting or surprising from the literature review I did, is that pirating was a problem from the beginning with tabletop role-playing games.
Oh, really?
Yeah, people were photocopying
D&D. Okay, yeah, yeah. Mm.
And distributing that.
There's
one number where perhaps there were actually more photocopied versions of the game than original versions of the game.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, you know, when I was a little kid, I didn't know where to go to buy D&D books. I rented them out from the local library.
Well, you did know where to go to buy D&D books. That guy with the trench coat who bullied you into buying us.
Exactly right.
You didn't need money to pay for that. You just needed your mouth.
A bat.
Oh.
Well, he's a trench coat, so.
All right, I was imagining pockets of dice on the inside, not nothing.
And, yeah, so that is a problem, of course, because the company's not getting the money. But, I mean, D&D didn't do too badly. I mean, it did grow fairly quickly as a company. Mm. And part of it is because the network grew faster than the products that they had available. And this was a time when, I mean, if you think back at those early books, I mean, photocopying it is really not much of a step down.
Right.
True. It was pretty much just plain paper, huh?
Then it comes to probably like the 80s or the 90s where, publishing, desktop publishing is a bit more sophisticated. People can lay it out a little bit better. Where then, photocopying did look like a step down. And there's so many pages that it was just as expensive to photocopy it. So, so pirating's been there in the beginning. And I guess you could say it didn't hurt the hobby back then. So the hobby can recover from pirating now. But it just needs to look at ways to kind of harness it.
Yeah.
All right. Well, this episode is actually running longer than we expected. So we're going to move what surprised us about the surveys to part two, in addition to talking about the positioning maps.
Cool.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us again on Idle Red Hands. Check us out online at www.idleredhands.com, idleredhands.com. You can listen to the episodes right there on the website or stream it through Stitcher or iTunes or download it off of DriveThruRPG. You can also like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, plus one us on G+, or sign up and speak to us in our forums. Our forums are hosted by Happy Jacks. Thank you very much, guys. And accessible at idleredhands.com/forums. You can also send us an email to info@idleredhands.com. Thanks a lot, and we'll see you next time.
Bye.
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 Drive-through RPG. We average 9 new titles a day. That's over 60 a week, and we've got well over 15,000 RPG titles online right now. DriveThruRPG, the one true source for RPGs.
Idle Red Hands, recorded in Kobe, Japan. See us online at www.idleredhands.com. Music provided by Tripod Jimmy, and the song was Roadkill. Hope you enjoyed it. See you next time.